From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, is Attorney General Ken Paxton perverting the facts about the death of baby Nikki and the looming execution of Robert Roberson?
This is deeply disturbing when you're talking about a government agency engaged in a false smear campaign of an autistic indigent guy on death row who's likely innocent.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Robert Roberson was supposed to be executed on October 17th. The man convicted of the 2002 shaken baby syndrome murder of his two-year-old daughter, Nikki, did not find relief from the courts or from Governor Greg Abbott. This is despite overwhelming evidence of innocence and overwhelming outcries from the public. The media and anti-death penalty protesters gathered that night outside the Walls Unit in Huntsville. That's where executions are carried out. The scheduled time of death, 6 p.m., came and went, and Roberson was still alive. There was a legal battle playing out over his fate. Standing in the way of the executioner, a subpoena from the Texas House Committee on Criminal Jurisprudence, which called for Roberson to testify just days later. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals ruled to ignore that subpoena. But 4 hours later, after that scheduled death time, and 2 hours before the death warrant expired, the state Supreme Court ruled that the execution needed to be halted. Here's how that was announced to the public outside the Walls Unit.
I'm here today to tell you all that Mr. Roberson did receive a stay. I had the opportunity to go back there to speak with him, and he was shocked, to say the least. He praised God, and he thanked his supporters.
After all this, for Roberson to be executed, he would take another death warrant. That needs to be requested by the Anderson County District Attorney, and under the law, there would be a 90-day wait period once granted. In the meantime, Texas Attorney General Republican Ken Paxton is looking to reset the public narrative about Roberson and erase the actual facts of the case, including what happened to baby Nikki, the trial record, and Roberson's own personal history. The AG office issued a report to the public that claimed it was setting the record straight, when in fact it was doing just the opposite. The biggest lie in the AG report is that Roberson was not convicted of the shaken baby death syndrome of his daughter, Nikki. However, on the October 21st House hearing on Roberson and the death penalty, Terry Compton, a juror in Roberson's original trial, testified that the case was tried as a shaken baby case as she was being questioned by Representative Brian Harrison.
Everything that was presented to us was all about shaken baby syndrome. That is what our decision was based on.
So it would be fair to say, from your perspective as a juror, this case was about shaken baby syndrome.
That was the only thing that was discussed or told to us that it was about.
That's the only thing?
Only thing.
Were you told anything about this little girl, Nikki, being beaten?
No.
So you heard nothing about Nikki being beaten as an explanation for what you witnessed in the jury room?
No.
Both Roberson's attorneys and members of the Texas House Committee on Criminal Justice released two separate detailed rebuttals to Paxton's report. I spoke to Roberson's attorney, Gretchen Swin, about that.
Setting the record straight, it's beyond irony. They don't cite to anything in the record. They spin this yarn about a fictional record they wish existed, at the same time saying, don't look at the real record, by trying to suggest this wasn't even a shaken baby case, when the trial transcripts are littered with the state's theme of how this was a shaken baby case. And even worse, they're trying to spin this narrative of a battery, when the whole reason it was a shaken baby case is because this poor child had very few signs of any external injury. And that one would create a lurid fiction to try to detract from this noble work these lawmakers have been doing to try to get at the truth here. I've never seen anything quite like it. And we have responded with a point-by-point rebuttal It's just always the challenge when you're in the realm of dirty tricks is that, you know, it's harder to respond with the truth. It's easy to lie, and then it takes work to dismantle that, show people the evidence. But that is what we're endeavoring to do. But I think every Texan should be really concerned about an office of government issuing a piece of paper with the seal of the state on it, where almost every sentence in it is a misrepresentation. And, you know, it seems to be part of some concerted smear campaign against this downtrodden autistic person who's innocent.
In the set of facts that we're getting from, I don't want to call them facts.
Yeah, I'm not going to call. In this litany of misinformation, yes.
That we're getting from the Attorney General's office, he says, according to doctors testifying at the trial, Nikki died from substantial blunt force head trauma, clearly indicated that the girl had been struck. Is that true?
No, and let me pick it apart. It is true that the doctor, the pathologist who did the autopsy, wrote blunt force trauma and then listed blunt force injuries in a report. Blunt force trauma is just this term that gets used often in shaken baby cases because it's this generic term that means there wasn't, you know, an open wound. You know, it didn't involve a knife or a gun. It's a palpable falsehood, A, that this was tried as a battery case, one, but the impacts language at trial was all mixed in with the shaking rhetoric, and it was the internal bleeding, which is a sign, you know, this, one of the shaken baby conditions that was being interpreted as just you can then presume trauma.
It looks like Paxton is just trying to reconstitute a totally different case against Robert Roberson, ignoring so much of what actually happened in January of 2002. When baby Nikki is brought into the hospital and the staff begins to try to resuscitate her and work on her. Then they call the Palestine Police Department saying, we have a shaken baby case on our hands. They're not talking about a battery. They didn't say we have a baby that was beaten to death. They are talking about shaken baby from the very beginning. That's what the detective talked about. That's what he investigated, and that's what they charged Robert Roberson with. Isn't that correct?
Yes, and there's one little nuance. When Robert brought Nikki into the local hospital there in Palestine, they didn't know what had happened. They just saw a comatose child whose lips had turned blue, and then her father that they thought looked odd and weird, and they were very judgmental about that because all he could say is she's been sick and she fell out of bed. And they didn't think that explained how she could be in this condition. The shaken baby diagnosis came when later that day she was transported to Dallas Children's Hospital. And that was the diagnosis that was faxed back to the police in Palestine and used to arrest Robert. Because that was the first explanation they got. And the whole point was, oh, shaken baby equals abuse. And he was the one who brought her in. Therefore, he's guilty of a crime. So it was the only explanation they had that led from mystery to criminal indictment is the shaken baby allegation. And this is a fundamentally circumstantial situation. Nobody saw what happened with Nikki in the early morning hours. But they didn't believe Robert, and they didn't know what we know today is that her illness could produce this exact condition. She was being starved for oxygen by lungs that were diseased and medications that were completely inappropriate. And that led for her to likely fall out of bed, bump her head, and then later cease breathing and end up with a subdural hematoma and a swollen brain. But the blood that was observed 2 days later comes from reviving her heart and then pushing all this blood into her system that couldn't enter her brain. So the whole idea that the blood itself is a sign of trauma, let alone inflicted trauma, is simply false. But the state's own evidence, these photographs they took of Nikki, show there's no blood. There are no bruises all over her face. There's no battery. And so for this to be spun about this child, it's so disrespectful to this poor little girl that the truth about what happened to her is being distorted simply to kind of squash Robert like some bug. It's just, it's heartbreaking.
Was Child Protective Services, were they ever reported, had a report on Robert Roberson and the way that he treated Nikki?
There were CPS investigations related to Nikki essentially from the time she was born. But I will remind you, Robert wasn't in her life until she was over a year old. So in fact, there was an investigation of the situation where she was living with her maternal grandparents. But there was never anybody, and this is very important, no one, no police record, no CPS record, nobody was reporting Robert being abusive to Nikki or to any child. Until trial, they started trying to drum up such evidence. And part of that really warped plan has to do with the fact that, you know, they had so little to go on. Robert had no history of violence. He didn't have that kind of criminal record. There was nobody that had reported him for such things. And so that's another really disturbing set of lies in this statement with the seal of the state affixed to it that's been sent out into the world.
But this statement from Attorney General Ken Paxton saying that witnesses at the trial said that they were afraid to leave Nikki alone with Roberson because he would repeatedly whip her whenever the baby cried.
This is fantasy. There were, three witnesses who were all related. One was his estranged girlfriend, who had been badgered and badgered to tell. There was a CPS case opened on her with the threat that she would lose her child if she didn't cooperate in trying to implicate Robert in some way. But her trial testimony is so incredible because one of the things she admitted on the stand was that she changed her story about Robert depending on how she felt at the moment. And so she responded these leading questions about, well, you know, didn't Robert shake Nikki in the past? And she would talk about, oh, yes, she was terrified of him. She would shake like a ghost when he came near her. And, you know, meanwhile, there were introduced at trial these pictures of, you know, Nikki sleeping in Robert's arms and him holding her. It's like, oh, yes, she was so terrified of him. She would never go near him. I mean, it's facially ridiculous. And for it now to be treated as if this were legitimate allegations that he perpetrated child abuse or domestic violence, all of this is, you know, it's really win at all cost blood sport kind of thing.
Paxton is bringing up the allegation that there was sexual abuse.
Yeah, and this is the worst of all because this was something that tainted the trial, I think, to such an extent that that alone should have been a reason for a new trial. But the state's position was, oh, well, it didn't prejudice him because the allegation of sexual abuse that was totally unsubstantiated got dropped before the jury started its deliberation. And that is absurd. We all know if you're sitting there hearing the state argue that they're going to prove sexual abuse and then they just drop it, you know, you've already let fly with that very poisonous insinuation. But the only thing they had was this suspicion from this nurse who took it upon herself to do a sexual assault exam on a comatose child when she did not have sane certification. And nobody had asked her to do this. And then later there was a sexual assault kit that was sent to DPS, tested, came back with nothing. And as the lead detective said, he thought that would be the end of it. But no, they took it to trial with no evidence. It poisoned the jury against Mr. Robertson. And then ever since, it's been, well, we dropped it, so it doesn't matter. And now here we come with a new one, even more outrageous, where a jailhouse snitch, and that's a term of art, it means some inmate in a jail who tries to ingratiate themselves with law enforcement or the DA's office by suggesting they can try to get them information, and what they want is a deal. Well, there was this character that Brian Wharton has described as completely unreliable. Everybody knew this guy. And he was writing letters to the DA that were extremely disturbing, but suggesting he could get them information, and then here's what he would like in terms of reduced time. This guy was a patent liar, and this never was, they didn't put him on at trial. But even worse, this was all happening after they already had the results from the sexual assault exam from DPS showing there was no basis for this. So to have this evidence that is not legitimate and was never put before the jury somehow resurface now, this is, again, deeply disturbing when you're talking about a government agency engaged in a false smear campaign of an autistic indigent guy on death row who's likely innocent. I mean, it stinks to the lowest depth of hell.
Well, with the fact that Paxton is moving away from shaken baby syndrome and trying to turn this into a case of battery, that the child was beaten to death, does that tell us something that they know that shaken baby syndrome can no longer be substantiated?
I think what it tells us is, first of all, Paxton's office didn't invent this tactic. This is what the local district attorney has been doing since 2016. After we filed our challenge based on the change in scientific understanding of shaken baby, they immediately took the position, oh, this wasn't really a shaken baby case, which I found stunning, because they must have read the same trial transcripts I read, and it was shaken baby from start to finish. So to me, that was already an acknowledgement that they were kind of in trouble, because no one would defend the version of shaken baby syndrome that was, you know, put before the jury as if it were scientific fact, and it's simply not. So it's been, but now the extreme distortions of what the record shows are accelerating. And again, they're contrary to the state's own evidence at trial. And part of that was an admission that Nikki did not have any broken bones, any extensive bruises. There was no blood at all. She had one minor bump on her head. And the whole point was they couldn't explain how she got in this condition, and they assumed it had to have been from shaking.
The night of October 17th, when Robert Roberson was due to be executed, where were you that night?
I was still at my computer, frantically filing things. There were developments unfolding in every moment, and there came a point where there was no way I could get in the car and get to Huntsville and see him. And it also, I had to make a call that, you know, where was I most needed? And I needed to continue to be litigating. The prison allowed me to call the unit and give him updates. You know, when he'd been transferred to Huntsville, you know, shortly after noon. So, and every time I called him, the news seemed to be worse. You know, more and more doors were slamming.
Right. The Supreme Court refused to take up the case.
Right.
And we were getting no help from Governor Greg Abbott. And it just seemed like these appeals were just not going to be taken up. And it looked bad until there was this hearing with the judge in Austin about the subpoena. How much hope did you put in that subpoena?
Well, that was a total surprise to me. I mean, what was moving is that this bipartisan group of lawmakers who had been studying Robert's case and were perplexed. Why had he not gotten a new trial? It seemed like the perfect case for it. And they then called a hearing to investigate using their classic legislative powers. But at the end of that day, as you know, the doors are slamming, they made a decision to use their powers to issue a subpoena, with the idea being he's somebody they needed to hear from. And if the subpoena was going to be worth anything, they would have to get what's called a temporary restraining order to keep the state from executing him long enough to get his testimony.
But you can't testify if you've been executed.
That's true. So it was a very creative and brave move, because no one could deny that that subpoena was valid. The argument the state started making was, well, that infringed on the powers of the Court of Criminal Appeals. And then again, the argument from the lawmakers was, well, wait, this is a matter of civil law. It's a separation of powers issue. The subpoena is civil. Why is the CCA the one that gets to weigh in? And they took it over to the Texas Supreme Court. And so 9-0, the Republican judges on the Texas Supreme Court agreed with the lawmakers. The restraining order held, and that meant we're in this temporary stay of the execution. But in the meanwhile, the execution warrant expired. But once this restraining order expires, there's nothing to stop the local DA from going back and seeking another execution date.
What was it like for Robert? What do you know about how he was handling this minute-by-minute turn of events, unprecedented legal maneuvering, efforts to save his life, efforts to end his life? He was in the middle of a power play.
It is unclear to me how much Robert was able to follow all this, but every time I called him and seemed to have nothing but grim news, I could just hear him sort of slipping away. His voice got softer and more childlike, and you know, he just got very monosyllabic. And then the last time when I called him to tell him about the restraining order, essentially giving him a stay of the execution, he was joyous, but he just kept saying, "Praise God and tell everyone who supports me, thank you." But they had already heard the news and were kind of celebrating there in Huntsville. But you know, just think about the human toll on anyone of sitting there counting down the hours, you know, wondering, are they going to come and take you away and this is going to be the end of it? I don't like to think too much about what that was doing to his psyche. But he was truly very, just very grateful that people were following his case, cared about his fate. And, you know, I'm delighted he's still with us. And so we live to fight another day. It's just the fight has entered a realm of, you know, that feels like mud wrestling.
And then we have the fight over whether or not he would be able to go to Austin to testify in person. Why was that so important? And where are we now on that?
Right, because the whole point was the subpoena which held was supposed to allow him to appear physically present in the Capitol to give testimony. And the reason I agreed to accept service was that was, you know, that's the norm. Then the next day, I'm communicating with prison officials who are very graciously explaining the process and being helpful. Everything seems to be, you know, on track. And then Saturday night, I learned through media that the attorney general has essentially directed its client to change course, and that Robert, if he appears, will only be via Zoom. And one thing you have to realize, we all do Zoom all the time. It's become a normal part of our life. Robert has never communicated with anyone over Zoom. He's been in solitary for 20 years. He does not have a computer in his cell. And the internet out there at the Polensky unit is very spotty. But the biggest problem is that Robert is a person with autism and has trouble enough engaging in communication, trouble with eye contact, trouble picking up on social cues. So if you cut him off from the in-person contact and put him over Zoom, something he doesn't have any experience with, I mean, it just seemed like a formula for disaster, that it was all it was going to do was create a very stressful situation, not allow the lawmakers to explore what they wanted to explore, which was his credibility. Who really is this person at the center of this debate? And what can he tell us about how the process went off the rails? So I know they're continuing to negotiate about a way to be able to interview him in person, but I'm not a party to those negotiations. You know, Robert is my client, but I'm not a party to the litigation. So I don't have a seat at the table.
We hear that there may be, the committee may go to Livingston, where the death row is, and have their hearing there.
That's something I heard during the hearing itself, that was one thing they were looking into. But again, I'm not a party to whatever negotiations are happening with the Attorney General's office. And then here we go with the latest development, which does not suggest good faith negotiations to me.
I mean, what do you mean? What's not good faith?
Oh, this defamatory statement they issued, right, with all of these factual misrepresentations of the case and of Robert, that kind of action, which would be sanctionable if this were submitted to a court. It's hard to believe that whoever's behind that is negotiating in good faith to have Robert testify.
But it does signal, you know, as you mentioned earlier, that they would have to issue a new death warrant. And that would be something that, you know, this tells us that they're not going to be shy about that. They will pursue executing him when they can.
Again, it's the local DA that will make that determination. But certainly it doesn't sound like the Attorney General's office has looked at this case and is recommending pressing the pause button.
A new trial. That's what you're looking for.
Right. And well, just simply a pause to, you know, I think the Attorney General is saying a bunch of things about this case that aren't true, that plainly show they don't know the case. And that to me is something that should disturb all Texans, that the mighty power of government is being used to do something that is untethered to the facts and the law. And something so consequential as a human life is at the center of this. That's troublesome.
Gretchen Swin is an attorney for death row inmate Robert Robertson. Robertson was scheduled to be executed on October 17th, but was saved by a subpoena from the state legislature investigating flaws in Texas death penalty appeals. Multiple independent experts have examined the court and medical records, concluded that Robertson is likely innocent and he deserves a new trial. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past episodes of Texas Matters, including a death row interview with Robert Robertson, on our website at tpr.org. And you can find Texas Matters wherever you download cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.